Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by the Heritage Meat Shop, located in the historic Essex Street Market in New York City. For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Did you know that during the 20s and 30s, many New Yorkers paid a gangster tax on basic goods like bread, milk, meat, fruits, and vegetables? We're going to learn all about it today when we come back on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio. And, you know, when we think of racketeering and all the gangsters in the roaring 20s, illegal booze is usually what we think of, the bootlegging and the Al Capone-type characters. But the rackets extended much further than most of us realize. And I have with me today Andy Coe. And Andy is an independent scholar and an author and historian. He's written the story of chop suey, a cultural history of Chinese food in the United States. And in Gastronomica a few years back, he wrote an article called The Egg Cream Rackets. Well, now this led to a lot of other information he uncovered, and that's on the rackets involving food, primarily in New York City altogether. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you, Linda.
So racketeering in the food. Well, I mean, you know, it's not, I can understand that, yeah, somebody's home in on my butter and egg route, and I'm going to try to force them out. But we're talking about something a lot bigger than mere strong arm tactics.
Right. I mean, these were organized criminal businesses whose purpose was to take control of some of the most basic edible commodities in New York City. We're talking milk and flour and things like that, and make huge amounts of money off of them.
Well, you just to sort of illustrate for people how far-reaching this was, the article you wrote in Gastronomica, I think 2004 it was, right? I've got it right here in front of me, in fact. it was on egg creams. Well, first of all, you sort of trace the history of the egg cream. What is the egg cream? And then how it kind of dissolved for a while into this, the food rackets really played large in the egg creams. Tell me a little bit about the background of egg creams.
Well, I mean, some people would call egg creams one of the most basic food groups in New York, and certainly from the 1920s on, egg creams were part of the New York diet. And just for anybody who doesn't know out there, egg creams are a soda fountain concoction made from milk, chocolate syrup, and seltzer water.
No eggs, no cream.
Yes, no eggs and no cream. And they were particularly popular in neighborhoods which were heavily populated with immigrants, like the Lower East Side and you know, districts like that in Brooklyn and other parts of New York City. And they were sold in neighborhood candy stores. And neighborhood candy stores were everywhere in New York City. So if you had, let's say, 10 or 15,000 neighborhood candy stores in New York City, every one of them with a little soda fountain in the back selling egg creams and other concoctions. Well, that adds up. I mean, you know, you're talking, let's say, a nickel or a dime for an egg cream. Well, those nickels and dimes add up, and they can add up into thousands, maybe even, after a while, into millions of dollars. And in 1929, a guy named Harry Solomon Dolowich decided to cash in on egg creams and other soda fountain drinks. And he organized a racket to take control of the industry.
So all these little small, and it was syrup. Did he start out primarily with the syrup that was used in the egg creams?
Yeah, well, I mean, there were other gangsters who were trying to take over seltzer water. And another gangster who had taken over the milk industry, but you know, in soda fountains, syrups are the crucial ingredient. And so what he did was he had actually grown up on the Lower East Side, the son of Jewish immigrants, and he'd married the daughter of one of the big syrup manufacturers. And Harry Dolowich, what he did was he talked to all the big syrup manufacturers and convinced them to form an association, the New York Syrup Manufacturers Association. And what that association did was that it set the price of syrup at a fairly high level. And anybody who didn't join the association, they would try to destroy. And so the big manufacturers, and by the way, that includes H. Fox and Sons, the manufacturers of Fox's You Bet.
You Bet syrup, which, right, chocolate syrup.
Yes, which is like now considered the only chocolate syrup you can use for egg creams. They all went along because this would cut out the competition and it would also keep prices artificially high. And by cutting out the competition, it wasn't done in any kind of innocent fashion or, you know, just by like good, clean business practices. They would they had what they called dead wagons, which would follow the delivery vans of the small mom and pop syrup manufacturers, slash the tires, put it foreign substances into their syrup and like badmouth them to the syrup stores. And people got ruined. And this was, you know, the early years of the Great Depression. And people were very afraid of like ending up on the street at that time. And these were, you know, small artisanal syrup producers. And it was very harsh.
Yeah, something we can really relate to today because, you know, there's that new boom of artisan. Today there's a new boom of all kinds of artisanal makers. And so you can see where this would be, how this would hurt somebody. All right, well, this extended far beyond egg creams. That's a fun story, though. That's really not a fun story. It was a disastrous story. But, I mean, it really paints a picture of what was going on that scale as far as rackets, but it extended far further than just syrup and seltzer.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one thing to understand about the food rackets and why they flourished during this time is to understand, get a picture of how food was distributed in New York City, because it's very, very different from today. I mean, today we have supermarkets and bodegas, and the food just kind of appears on the shelves. And we really don't know where it comes from. You know, we're sure there are delivery trucks, we see them driving around, but we don't know, you know, where the food comes from. The wholesale markets are essentially invisible. But back then, everything was the food industry was a lot bigger, was a lot more spread out. And a lot more complicated than it was today. Food came into New York City either by rail or by boat, occasionally by truck. It landed at the piers or at the rail terminals. From there it was brought to these giant wholesale markets, like the Washington Market at the site of the World Trade Center was one of them, or the Fulton Fish Market on the East Side. And then it was there. It was sold, like passed through a number of hands, from the big commission merchants who were like the big dealers in wholesale goods, to dozens of different kinds of small-time jobbers who brought the foods from the wholesale markets through the streets of New York to the individual stores. And you know, at certain times of the day, the streets of New York were crammed with all kinds of delivery vans. From everything from horse-drawn, farmers' wagons to big trucks delivering food. So it was like spread out all over the place, with lots and lots of different levels and kinds of food distribution. And it was very sort of disorganized, and it gave criminals a great opportunity to become involved and make a buck.
Hmm. Well, yeah, in the movies we still see, you know, images of, let's say, even in The Sopranos, of them hijacking a cigarette truck, you know, and then taking all the cigarettes and selling them, you know, bootlegging the cigarettes. So this is nothing new. This was going on then, right?
No, it was absolutely nothing new. And people, this was much more like a kind of like evolution, you know, in the raw. I mean, it was like people were struggling to survive even before the Depression. People were struggling. And living and working in the New York City food industry was like a constant battle every day of just struggling for space, from the parking space to customers or to whatever. Everybody was constantly sort of at each other's throats trying to make a dollar, to make a living in New York.
Well, now, setting prices there, this is not a small thing. Setting a price, we read about this all the time with the milk industry, particularly, you know, when the dairy farmer is suffering with the, you know, the prices for whatever reasons are set too low or, you know, too high. So organized crime was really the one who had a big hand once they got in and controlled these illegal monopolies, in other words, on the food industry. They set the price, right?
Right. Let's start with like the sort of first food racket, which as an illustration of how they worked. The first food racket was actually one of the biggest. It was one of the biggest food industries in New York, and you might be surprised to hear what it was: kosher poultry.
Huh.
Kosher chicken was huge because Jewish immigrants and the children of Jewish immigrants needed fresh killed chicken for their Friday evening meal. And there were a lot of Jewish immigrants in New York City. It was like the largest Jewish city in the world, essentially. And thousands and thousands of birds got sold every week. And this added up to literally millions of dollars a year in sales. So, and the kosher poultry industry was based in the West Washington Market, which is at the site more or less of today's Meatpacking District. Mm-hmm. And they had something called Chicken City or Chicken Village, which was a series of buildings which must have smelled terribly.
Oh, yeah.
If you've ever been to a chicken farm. And the noise must have been incredible as well. And around 1910, there were a bunch of dealers, wholesale live chicken dealers, who got very angry at one of their competitors, a guy named Barney Baff. And Barney Baff, rather than join them and keep the prices of chickens relatively high, like they wanted to do, he was undercutting them in the market, and they didn't like it. And so they formed an association of the New York City chicken merchants. And this association first tried to convincing him not to to undercut them in prices. And when that didn't work, they poisoned his horses. They slashed the tires of his delivery vehicles. They bombed his house.
Huh.
And still that didn't work. So what they did was, this association of largely Jewish chicken merchants, is that they one of them knew a guy in East Harlem. And the guy in East Harlem knew somebody else who was like an Italian immigrant guy who was semi-criminal. And they gave him a gun and sent him down to Chicken Village. And a guy named Chicken Moe pointed out Barney Baff and said, "That's the guy." And this young Italian immigrant shot him and killed him right there in Chicken Village. And this turned into a huge, huge scandal in the 19 teens. And eventually the people who were involved were arrested and convicted. But guess what? Within a few years, all of them had been released, even the people who had been convicted of murder. Because this was a very different era in New York City, and corruption was everywhere.
Right. Well, we all have read the history books about Tammany Hall and the corrupt politicians. I would imagine that they, a lot of the politicians didn't, or even you know, judges or district attorneys, didn't want to handle these cases.
Well, I don't think that they didn't want to handle the cases, but they were, I mean, they didn't, they were being paid off.
They were on the take, too.
They were on the take. And so they just, you know, they would, they had to do one thing for, because the, all the newspapers were getting down on them for, you know, not going after these guys. But then, like, you know, after the things had calmed down, then they, oh, they found like a little problem with the indictment or something like that. And they managed to get him out.
Yeah.
Well, so they were back on the street and actually back in the kosher poultry racket within a few years.
Interesting. And you said they bombed the guy's house. So we were we're talking about some drastic tactics that were used. You know, killing, bombs, and Murder Inc. Tell us about Murder? Where did Murder Inc. come?
Well, Murder Incorporated. This was a criminal organization which wasn't just limited to the food rackets. What it was in the 1930s, a bunch of people in Jewish and Italian organized crime decided that it would be much more efficient to have a special team of people to dispatch enemies, i.e. kill them, rather than have people within your own organization do it. You could just like call up Murder Incorporated and have a specialist do the work rather than have somebody who wasn't perhaps quite as professional. And the head of Murder Incorporated was a guy named Lepka Buchalter, who was a short gentleman who'd grown up on the Lower East Side and had grown up with Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, and Lucky Luciano, people who are well-known names in the criminal side of life. And Lepke began his career as a strong arm guy. They called him a gorilla. And he first made his name in union rackets, busting garment workers' unions, and also in the food rackets. And the big food racket that he was involved in was the flour racket. You know, bread was one of the basic foodstuffs in New York City during the 1920s and 1930s. And he managed to take control of the flour industry.
So from the delivery of the grain to the mills to the how far reaching was it?
Well, to take control of the industry, you don't have to take control of every step of it. You only have to take control of a crucial step of it, because if you can hold up one step along the distribution line, then the whole thing falls apart.
You affect the final outcome and the price, right? So.
Right. And the crucial step which he took control of was flour truckmen, people who delivered the flour. Because if the bakeries couldn't get the flour, they couldn't make the bread.
Right.
And so he controlled the flour truckmen, and that means that the bakeries had to pay him off in order to get their flour delivered. And anybody who crossed him was beaten or murdered. There was a guy who was a union leader in a rival flour trucking union, and he didn't want to go along with Lepke and his plans. And they said, "Well, why don't you come down and meet us at a restaurant? And we'll discuss this." And it was Garfine's Kosher Banquet Hall on the Lower East Side on Houston Street. And it happened to be empty at the time. And there was like a corner table with one light over it.
Oh, this is a movie.
And they all were gathered around the table. And this man, William Snyder, the union leader, came in. And the last seat, which was available, was the one with his back to the door.
Mm-hmm.
And they started talking. And, you know, a signal was, I think a blind was raised and then lowered. And a young man came in from the street with a gun to his side and shot Mr. Snyder and murdered him.
Hmm. Well, the Godfather, we know where they got their source material.
Yes,
now.
Yes.
Well, we're gonna find out a little bit about the crime busters when we come back after this short break.
You're listening to Penny by Snowmine on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You said your love, but it let you down.
following is a message from the Heritage Meat Shop.
Are you tired of just hearing buzzwords? Do you want to actually take part in the food revolution? Then come on down to the Heritage Meat Shop, located in New York's historic Essex Street Market, on the corner of Essex and Delancey. We have rare breed pork, beef, poultry, lamb, and goat, not to mention charcuterie that'll make you squeal. All raised right, by the right people, so you know they'll taste right. Try the meat that over 100 New York chefs ache for. Come to the Heritage Meat Shop and pick up some revolution today.
For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com.
Hey, we are back here on A Taste of the Past, and I'm talking with Andy Coe. We're talking about the rise of the illegal food rackets. Well, a racket is illegal, but rise of the food rackets in New York City. And Andy, I have a question. Did the food rackets, I would imagine this, there were food rackets in major cities like Chicago and San Francisco.
Chicago definitely. I don't know about San Francisco, but Chicago actually definitely had food rackets. In fact, they coined the term racketeering in Chicago.
Right. I actually had read that and recall that. So that's not just New York City that's so corrupt. But, yeah, I mean, you get that many people together and something's going to happen. About how long did the food rackets endure? How long did that go on? We talked about the teens and the 20s. How long did it go on?
Well, the first food racket that I was able to find was the poultry racket, which started around 1910. And they lasted into the 1930s. And, actually during the 1930s, they really became, in the early 1930s, they kind of like turned up the volume on the food rackets, the criminals did. Because, you know, this was the early years and the worst years of the Great Depression. And I think racketeers, A, knew that Prohibition was ending and that that was the big cash cow for them. So they were looking for other businesses to get involved in. I mean, gambling was one of them, but food certainly added to their profits. And also, the business owners who were like colluding with the food racketeers were also really struggling to survive. And this is one of the ways which they could survive was to band together and essentially, beat and kill their competition. So, that was like the racketeers and the manufacturers had a kind of partnership there. But this was the Depression, and in New York City, in 1935, Fiorello LaGuardia became mayor. Mm-hmm. And before him, it had been Jimmy Walker and then a short-lived mayor, in the interim. But, corruption was everywhere. And LaGuardia came in determined to clean up shop. And one of the first things he did was go against one of the rackets we haven't talked about, which was the Italian artichoke racket. And there's a big racket in the Italian
artichoke. Who would have guessed Italian artichokes? Well, I mean, we don't want to say anything against Italians, and especially since I married a lovely Italian man. But importing the Italian artichokes, tell me about that.
Well, let's see how to start. Artichokes have been grown in the United States for decades and centuries. But Italians like different artichokes than the big French-style globe artichokes that we knew. They like smaller, more delicately flavored Italian artichokes. And even if they were poor immigrants, on the big feast days and things like that, they wanted food from Italy. They wanted imported spaghetti, they wanted imported olive oil, and they wanted good imported Italian small artichokes. So there was a business here. And a guy named Joe Morello, a.k.a. Clutch Hand, because he had a deformed hand, he was a gangster in the early version of the Mafia. And he told them, the artichoke dealers, on every case of artichokes that you sell, you have to give me a cut or else. And his stepbrother, a guy named Ciro Terranova, eventually took over the artichoke racket and became known as the Artichoke King. And he made so much money from artichokes that he drove around the streets of New York in an armored car. Hmm. So it was big business. And LaGuardia, he's half Italian American, the other half I think was Jewish, but he was very sensitive to crime in the Italian immigrant population, and he was he felt insulted by the artichoke racketeers, and he went into the markets, and what he did was close down I think one of the old East Harlem markets which was big in the artichoke racket, and built a new market structure and told everybody that that all the dealers is that they had to like reapply for their market permits in order to join and sell artichokes there. And for a while he banned the sale of artichokes in New York City until he could clean this up.
Interesting. Well, I mean, the docks have been known always for being ripe with corruption.
Yes.
And a lot of criminals hanging out there. So obviously, you know, any food coming in and out of ports was a target.
Well, I mean, this is interesting, actually, the docks. This is really before refrigeration was widespread. Mm. So food would come in on boats, and it had to be, like, moved very quickly from the docks to the markets to the stores. But if somebody said, like a dock workers union said, well, we're not going to unload your bananas or whatever unless you give us a payoff, well, the bananas would rot in the hold.
Right.
And so that's, I mean, that was very, very common on the docks at that time.
Wow. Yeah. So LaGuardia, this was in the mid, late 30s when...
Well, it was 1934, 1935 when he started to sing. But he was only a mayor. I mean, you know, mayor only has, you know, he's not a prosecutor or a judge or anything like that. And the people who ran the governor's office at upstate, people up in Albany had, you know, for centuries, essentially, had always been sort of like tired of like corruption and criminality in New York City and trying to clean up New York City. And they hired a federal prosecutor named Thomas Dewey, to clean up crime and racketeering in Manhattan. And he went after all the big rackets. He went after a guy named Arthur Tootsie Herbert, who took over the poultry racket. He went after Lepke Buchalter and the flour racket. And he was actually quite successful.
Interesting. So when we buy our food today... Do we have any assurances that it is corruption free? Yeah. There's different types of corruption, I guess.
Yes, there's different types of corruption, but the food distribution system is very different. But that said, you know, one of the big rackets which we haven't talked about was the fish racket in the Fulton Fish Market, which was begun by a guy named Joseph Sox Lanza. You know, Sox, because you know, well, you can imagine why he was called Sox. And corruption in the Fulton Fish Market didn't really end until 2005, when Giuliani finally forced the Fulton Fish Market to move up to Hunts Point.
That's right, closed.
And all the old fish dealers, in order to work at Hunts Point, had to reapply for their permits, and they had to. And actually, the market was run by the federal government for a number of years, and may still be, just to make sure that everything is squeaky clean up there.
Hmm. So taking a page from LaGuardia's book, he just basically closed down Fulton Fish Market. I mean, moved it, right?
Yes,
yeah. Yeah. You know, I know a lot of times today, rather than racketeering, there are ways to get around monopolies and with the patents that, you know, occur on, let's say, ice cream. An artisanal ice cream maker wants to get on the shelves of a big supermarket, but a big dairy company doesn't want the competition, so they will... basically buy them out and then just put them on the shelf squelch them, not even bring them to market. I mean, there are still practices that go on, but it's not, you can't call it organized crime for sure.
No, but I mean, businesses still practice what I would consider as cutthroat business practices. They're not illegal, but they're definitely meant to undercut the competition, and sometimes, and a lot of times, these are, you know, small artisanal producers. I mean, I can, mm-hmm. you know, I know I write a lot about the bread industry in New York, and I won't name names, but there was a small producer of really good, still is, of really good Scandinavian-style rye bread. And there was a big market chain in New York, and for a while, the market chain was buying this rye bread. And selling it, and it was great, and I used to go there and buy it. But then the market chain opened its own bakery and started producing its own version of rye bread, which was vastly inferior, but it was undercutting. You know, it was obviously a copy of this great rye bread, and it was undercutting their market.
Hmm.
So I mean, that's what goes still today.
Yeah, I mean, you know, business is very competitive. There's a way, and the more laws and rules we have on the books, the more educated people will become and find ways around it. You know, they're going to do things to you know, climb over other people's backs and,
yes.
Well,
succeed
a business. But the artisanal growers and producers, I think, have a much easier time of it today, I would imagine.
Right. But if you actually look, though, over time at things from, you know, the counter in your local gourmet store or in the supermarket shelf, I mean, if you study these things over time, you realize that there's a slow motion battle going on there for shelf space. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the most precious commodity in the food industry.
You're absolutely right,
and
shelf space.
And this thing, I mean, it's, you know, people are fighting for shelf space and people, you know, lives, you know, people's livelihoods are made and ruined by gaining shelf space or losing it. And that's really what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a young woman was a soda producer in Brooklyn, and it took her, I think it took her easily about 8 to 10 years to get her soda on the shelves of even small markets. You know, forget the big supermarkets. I don't know if they, you know, if she ever got on there, but, you know, just determination, and she kept at it. And I'm glad you mentioned your Good Bread article, because I forgot to mention it. Andy writes a column for SiriusEats.com called Good Bread. So you can read some of these interesting tales on your Good Bread. Mostly all about bread, I would imagine.
Yes, all about great bakeries around New York City.
Well, I know there are so many other interesting stories that we could uncover on the history of New York and obviously the food rackets. But this has been a nice stepping stone for an education on how far we've come and what a much more pleasant world it is now to go to the markets. And
what our ancestors were up to back then.
That's for sure. Well, Andy, thank you so much. And listeners, I want to remind you that heritageradionetwork.org is a member-supported network. So please, if you go to our website and you see the donate page, click it and look at your options. It's easy to join, and we really do need your help so we can hear more of these wonderful tales from our guests. Hope you'll join me again on A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.